Last week, as you may recall, we focused on Saadia Gaon, and particularly on his introduction of a new kind of categorization or classification of mitzvot, one of which he called mitzvot sichliyot, rational mitzvot, and the other he called mitzvot shim'iyot, best translated perhaps as revealed mitzvot. And his explanation was that there is a category of mitzvot that reason alone is sufficient to minimally recommend them, maximally to make them obligatory. And those are the kinds of things that are required to maintain any well-ordered society or civilization, such as prohibitions against murder, against theft, etc. And the other category of mitzvot, the revealed ones, were mitzvot that reason alone was not sufficient. Reason alone may have been sufficient to recommend them, but not necessarily sufficient to make them mandatory. The problem was that over the passage of time, many people, perhaps even most people, failed to observe that fine distinction. And they gave Saadia Gaon's two categories a more popular or conventional interpretation. And they understood him to mean that some of the mitzvot could be explained rationally, and that the other mitzvot simply were not rational. And there were a lot of people who were content with that, people who did not see any advantage, let alone any necessity, in maintaining that mitzvot are necessarily rational. And here we have an example of such an approach by the 12th century Spanish Jewish philosopher Yehuda Halevi in his well-known book, the Sefer HaKuzari. Now, Yehuda Halevi, just parenthetically, is very often compared with Maimonides. They had two very, very different fundamental approaches to Jewish philosophy and theology, and indeed the question of mitzvot and why we perform mitzvot is yet another illustration of that contrast between them. So here we have Yehuda Halevi's view articulated, as it were, by the king of the Khazars, who says that the theory I had formed and the opinion of what I saw in my dream, if you recall the basic plot behind the whole book, is that the king of the Khazars had a dream in which he was told, if you remember the recurring phrase, Kavanatcha Ritzuya Eitzel HaBorei, that your intentions are found desirable by God, Aval Ma'asecha Einam Ritzuyim, but your deeds are not desirable. And that led him, as you may recall, to seek advice or direction from representatives of each of the three monotheistic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So here he says that in the opinion of what he saw in his dream, you now confirm, that is to say, the philosopher representing Judaism now confirmed, namely, that man can only merit divine influence by acting according to God's commands. That is to say that a human being's responsibility is to do what God tells him to do. Okay? And he says, in more specifically here, all this was systematically arranged by God. I do not by any means assert that the service was instituted in the order expounded by me. This is the philosopher speaking. Since it entailed something more secret and higher and was based on a divine law. And here's the critical phrase. He, which means anyone, who accepts this, that is to say, divine commands, completely, without scrutiny or argument, is better off than he who investigates and analyzes. Okay. authors, either philosophers themselves or scholars of medieval Jewish philosophy, when they discuss these two approaches towards Tamei HaMitzvot, Yehuda HaLevi on one hand and Maimonides and others on the other hand, often refer to it as will versus wisdom. The position represented here by Yehuda HaLevi sees mitzvot as the will of God, and therefore all man has to do, in fact, all that man is entitled to do, is to bend before the will of God. The other position, the one that we began to see in Saadia and that we will see in a moment it reaching its climax in Maimonides, sees mitzvot as an expression not so much of God's will as of God's wisdom. And therefore, they see it not only as useful or advisable, but even necessary to seek the rationales behind mitzvot. And that, again, just to simply cite one of Maimonides' other predecessors in this regard, is also the position taken by the famous Bible commentator Avraham Ibn Ezra in a book he wrote called Yesod Morah, if you wish, The Basis of Faith, okay, in which he too takes out a position on Ta'amei HaMitzvot. And I just simply chose, I thought, two representative paragraphs in it. Some mitzvot, he maintains, are explained in the Torah. We saw that in our opening class. Okay? Others would be inexplicable. Those are the ones that we've seen that both the Talmud and the medievals tended to call chukim. Right? Others would be inexplicable were it not for the saintly traditionists, right? He calls HaKadoshim, HaMa'atikim, okay, who transmitted them father to son and teacher to student. And indeed, he says, Lulei HaKabbalah, were it not for tradition, one would be able to offer other explanations or interpretations of mitzvot. There are other mitzvot we received from the sages, he maintains, that are not even mentioned in the Torah. And then he says, Hinei lecha klal, this is the rule. Without the wisdom of the men of the Grand Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, and the scholars of the Mishnah and the Talmud, the Tanaim and the Amoraim, he says, Torat Eloheinu, he says, Nishkach Zichra, that God forbid the divine Torah would have been lost and forgotten. They, the sages, clarified everything and explained all the mitzvot fully. How? Through tradition. For some of the mitzvot, they found explicit support in the Torah, while other mitzvot were derived through hermeneutics, drash, or were simply linked to the text, what the Talmud calls asmachta. And Ibn Ezra says, and this is the key line, an intelligent person, Nishayesh lo lev, an intelligent person, can distinguish between interpretations of mitzvot that are hermeneutic, that are drash, and those that are pshat, that are the plain text, because he says they are not all the same. So on the one hand, we have the school of thought represented by Yehuda HaLevi that says that it's probably not even useful to seek the rationales behind mitzvot. All one is obliged to do is obey. And the other school of thought represented by Ibn Ezra, and that is more in line with Saadia, his predecessor, and Rambam, his successor, is to seek reasons for the mitzvot. And that brings us to Rambam. Rambam, born in Spain, in either 1135 or 1138, even to this day, scholars and historians are not 100% in agreement on it. His father Maimon, on account of which he's called Maimonides, was a dayan, a judge in the city of Cordoba. And at the approximate age of 13, his family, along with many other Spanish Jews, fled to North Africa in order to escape persecution by a fanatical Muslim sect known in English sources as the Almohads. The Arabic word Al-Muwahadun sounds a bit Hebrew. The word Wahad is Arabic for Echad, one. And what distinguished them is that they gave tremendous stress on the principle of the unity of God. From their perspective, not only were Jews and Christians heretics, but they considered many other Muslims to be heretics as well. In any event, from Morocco in North Africa, the family of Maimon moved to Fustat, Old Cairo, where Maimonides himself practiced medicine while composing his many philosophical and halachic works, and he died in December of 1204. I cannot vouch or even tell you anything about the origin of this widely distributed ostensible portrait of Maimonides, but I can vouch for the signature, because the signature, as you see, of Moshe Barabi Maimon Zatzal, right, Moses, the son of the late Maimon, happens to appear exactly in the same form on one of several responsa of Maimonides that have been recovered from the Cairo Geniza. Not copies of responsa that he wrote, but actually autographic, or some call it holographic responsa, that is written in his own hand. Basically, this is the position of Maimonides on mitzvot. In the words of one of the 20th century's best known and most highly regarded interpreters of Maimonides, the late professor Rabbi Isidore Twersky of Harvard University, who wrote that the search for meaning and purpose of the commandment, the fervent struggle to find its rationale, is a basic component of the knowledge of God and the means for advancing a person on the path to perfection. Here he's presenting Rambam's view of mitzvot. If one has no awareness of the ultimate purpose of a mitzvah, then behavior, that is to say, the observance or performance of the mitzvah, becomes perfunctory. It's almost automatic or robotic, carrying out the commandments from mindless habit. In doing so, Twersky tells us, Rambam would believe that such a person fulfills his obligations, his yotzei yedei chova, but obtains no spiritual benefit from the effort, because he is doing it as an automaton, and he's not doing it out of a sense of conviction, because he lacks the understanding that is a necessary prerequisite for conviction. And here we'll begin, here we will see this in Rambam's own words, beginning at almost the very beginning of the Guide to the Perplexed. In this segment, Rambam is responding to what he calls a widespread fallacy in the way people understand the story of the Garden of Eden. And the fallacy is that people think that since it was only after Adam ate from the tree of knowledge that he had a brain, and that somehow before he ate from the tree of knowledge, he didn't know anything. And Rambam explains that there are different kinds of knowledge. And he speaks of two categories of knowledge, one of which we would call objective knowledge, things that are either objectively true or objectively false. The second category of knowledge is one we would call subjective knowledge, and that is whether something is good or bad. Because something is objectively true doesn't mean necessarily that it's good. And conversely, because something is objectively false doesn't necessarily mean that it is subjectively bad. Therefore, what Rambam maintained is that Adam, from the time that God created him, was endowed with the capacity to understand true and false, emet and sheker. What he lacked until he ate from the Eitz HaDa'at was the ability to distinguish between good and bad. And that's why it's called the Eitz HaDa'at Tov Vara. Okay. So consistent with that distinction, Rambam says, the intellect, that was granted to man as the highest endowment, that's what distinguishes man from other creatures, was bestowed upon him before his disobedience. Again, that's the knowledge, that's the objective knowledge of emet and sheker, of true and false. With reference to this gift, the Bible states that man was created in the form and likeness of God, Tselem Elohim. On account of this gift of intellect, man was addressed by God and received his commandments. God could not command somebody who did not have the intellectual capacity to understand what he was being told to do. As it is said, Vayitzav Hashem Elohim et ha'adam. For no commandments are given to the brute creation, that is to say, to animals, or to those who are devoid of understanding. Through the intellect, man distinguishes between true and false. And this faculty, right, as opposed to the distinction between good and bad, right, this faculty, the ability to distinguish between true and false, Adam possessed perfectly and completely. You can see already how this is going in the direction that Professor Tversky defined. It is here in the third of the three parts of the Guide to the Perplexed that Rambam deals at length and in great detail with the subject of Ta'amei HaMitzvot. And here he writes as follows. There are persons who find it difficult to give a reason for any of the commandments, and these people consider it right to assume that the commandments and prohibitions have no rational basis whatever. Right? Pretty much as we saw encapsulated in the Kuzari. They are led to adopt this theory, he maintains, by a certain disease in their soul. Very clear now what his view is of such an opinion. The existence of which they perceive, but which they are unable to discuss or to describe. For these people imagine that these precepts, these mitzvot, if they were useful in any respect and were commanded because of their usefulness, right, as opposed to just simply being the arbitrary will of God, would seem to originate in the thought and reason of some intelligent being. But as things which are not objects of reason and serve no purpose, then they would undoubtedly be attributed to God because no thought of man could have produced them. Meaning, these people, and you can see why he considers this to be an illness, these people say, well, who needs a God to tell me not to do something that I wouldn't do anyway? Meaning, if I can think on my own that it's not proper to kill or to rob, then I don't need God to tell me that. I need God to tell me something that I wouldn't think of on my own. According to the theory of those weak-minded people, he continues, man then is arguably more perfect than his creator, because what man says or does has a certain object, it has a certain conviction to it, while the actions of God are different. God, as it were, commands us to do something that is of no use to us, because we would have otherwise thought of it on our own, and forbids us to do things that would be harmless, again, because if they would be harmful, we ought to be able to think of it ourselves. And here's his response to this. He says, far be this. On the contrary, the sole object of the law, he says, is to benefit us. Thus we explained, and he quotes a pasuk, where Moshe says about the mitzvot, letov lanu kol hayamim, that is for our good always, lechayotenu kayom hazeh, that God might preserve us alive, kayom hazeh, as we are all here today. And again, it talks about any people who will hear. We saw this pasuk previously, right? That other nations will hear all about these chukim, and they will say, ki rak am chacham v'navon hagoy hagadol hazeh. He thus says that even every one of chukim convinces the nations of the world of our wisdom and understanding. However, if these people are right, and there is no reason for these chukim, if they produce no advantage, if they remove no harm or evil, then why should anyone believe in them? And why should anyone who believes in them and follows them be considered wise and reasonable? And why would anybody want to praise them for it? Therefore, quite to the contrary, Rambam says, the truth is undoubtedly, as we have said, namely, that every one of the 613 mitzvot serves to inculcate some truth, to remove some erroneous opinion, to establish proper relations in society, to diminish evil, to train in good manners, or to warn against bad habits. And here again, in more synoptic form, from yet another part of the third section of the guide, Rambam says, marvel exceedingly at the wisdom of God's commandments, just as you marvel at the wisdom manifested in the things he has made. Rambam maintains that a way in which to come to know God is to study nature, because nature is such an expression of God's wisdom that we, whose own wisdom pales in comparison to his, ki lo machshevotai machshevoteichem, can nevertheless learn something about God, perceive something about God by studying his handiwork, nature. And Rambam says that just as we see nature as an expression of God's wisdom, so we should see mitzvot as an expression of God's wisdom. And indeed, he quotes a pasuk, Hatzur, God, the rock, Tamim pa'olo, all that God does is flawless, is perfect. And then it says, Ki chol drachav mishpat. And his interpretation is that just as the things made by him, nature, are consummately, should be consummately, not consumedly, consummately perfect, so are God's commandments consummately perfect. In fact, it isn't only in the guide where Rambam is philosophizing that he maintains that mitzvot are rational and that it is incumbent upon us to seek the rationales, but he even maintains it as a halacha. And here we have a halacha. It's from the eighth halacha in the eighth chapter of Hilchot Me'ilah, the laws that prohibit trespass against the Beit HaMikdash, against the temple. Hilchot Me'ilah, the laws of trespass, happen to be the last subsection in Sefer HaAvodah, the one of the 14 major books of the Mishneh Torah that deals with things that went on in the temple and in the temple service. So Hilchot Me'ilah is the last subsection in Sefer HaAvodah. Chapter 8 is the last chapter in Hilchot Me'ilah. And Halacha Chet is the last halacha in the last chapter of the last subsection of Sefer HaAvodah. I mention this because it happened to have been Rambam's habit throughout Mishneh Torah that in the closing law of the closing chapter of the closing subsection of the 14 major parts of the Mishneh Torah, he would tend to wax somewhat more philosophical than be somewhat more narrowly halachic. So here's what Rambam has to say. I haven't been reading the Hebrew up until now because the Hebrew of the Moreno Ruchim is only a translation of the Arabic original, and there's really no advantage per se in not going straight to the English. But here, it's the Mishneh Torah, which Rambam deliberately wrote in Hebrew, so we should spend a little time just reading it. Ra'oi la'adam, it is worthy of a human being, lehitbonen b'mishpatei ha'Torah ha'kedosha, to analyze, investigate the laws of the Holy Torah, v'leida, in order to ascertain, sof inyanam kifi kocho, in order to comprehend them, to get, if it were, to the bottom of it, to the best of his ability. Right off the bat, Rambam says, seeking rationales for mitzvot is something that is worthy of everyone. V'davar shelo yimtza lo ta'am, if, however, one is unsuccessful in seeking a rationale for any mitzvah, v'lo yedalo ila, and one cannot find a persuasive cause for it, Rambam says, al yihi kal be'enav, let him not be dismissive of it. Va'al yaharos la'alot el Hashem pen yifrots bo. Translation, let him not attempt to forcibly ascend unto God, lest God strike him down. Rambam here is borrowing from the language with which Moshe prepares the Jewish people for Matan Torah. Right, we're studying the mitzvot, the Tameh mitzvot, specifically in anticipation of Shavuot. So it's important to know that Moses warned the Jewish people on the eve of Matan Torah not to ascend the mountain. Right, says, don't try to go up the mountain because God won't let you do it. Pen yifrots bam, right, that God would strike you down. So Rambam is borrowing that imagery, and he's saying that if somebody were to reject a mitzvah, somebody were to decide not to observe a mitzvah only because he was unsuccessful in finding a persuasive rationale for it, that would be tantamount to trying to ascend Mount Sinai. In other words, you're putting yourself, as it were, on the same level with God. Therefore, Rambam says, lo tehe machashavto bo, that one's thoughts in regards to a mitzvah should not resemble machashavto b'sha'ar divrei hachol. Right? In secular affairs, in matters of science, for example, says Rambam, reason, intellect is supreme. Anything that is unreasonable, anything that defies intellectual investigation in the realm of science, says Rambam, should probably be rejected. But that's not the way to think about religious affairs. And now he tells us what this has to do with the laws of Mi'ilah, with the laws of trespass. And he says, Bo ure'e, come and see, Kama hechmira Torah b'mi'ila, how seriously the Torah treats the subject of trespass. Uma imetzim va'avanim ve'afar va'efer, if with regards to inanimate objects, trees and stones, kevan shenikra shem adon ha'olam aleihem bidvarim bilvad, all one needs to do is pronounce the words Kodesh Lashem, right? And what happens? Nitkadshu. These inanimate objects become sanctified and it becomes prohibited to use them. That would be trespass. That would be me'ilah. V'chahanoheg bahim in hagchol. And anybody from that point on treated them as mundane objects, ma'al bashem, is guilty of trespass, right? V'afilu haya shogeg. And even if he did so only inadvertently, right? Tzarich kapara, he has to bring a korban in order to atone for it. Okay. Therefore, right? That was the kal. What's the chomer? Kal vachomer lemitzvot shechakak lanu akadosh baruch hu. Then how much more so should we be sensitive in our approach to mitzvot that God enacted? Shelo yivot adam bahen mipnei shelo yada ta'aman. Let no one, as it were, trample them simply because he was unable to find a rationale for them. V'lo yechaper dvarim asher lo chein al Hashem. Because even if it were to impute to God, to accuse God, as it were, of mandating something that has no reason, is effectively casting an aspersion against God. V'lo yachshov bahen machashavto b'divrei hachol. And therefore he says, one should not treat Torah matters the same way that one treats the secular or mundane affairs. So Rambam's position here is very clear. Everyone should at all times exercise his intellect in search of rationales for mitzvot, with the understanding that one is obliged to continue to observe and to perform them, even if one fails to satisfy one's own intellectual curiosity about them. But how do you go about satisfying your intellectual curiosity? Rambam developed a certain approach to mitzvot that we might call psychological, and another approach to mitzvot that we would call historical. Here is an example of his psychological approach. Notice again, drawn from the third part of the Moreh HaNevuchim. On considering divine acts or the processes of nature, we get an insight into the prudence and wisdom of God. You remember the previous slide in which he equated, right, God's works, the works of nature, with the mitzvot. Many precepts, mitzvot in our law, are the result of a similar course adopted by the same supreme being. It is namely impossible to go suddenly from one extreme to the other. Right? That's a psychological observation. It is therefore, according to the nature of man, impossible for him suddenly to discontinue everything to which he has been accustomed. Now, God sent Moses to make the Israelites Mamlechet Kohanim v'Goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. How? By means of the knowledge of God. But the custom, which was in those days general amongst all men, and the general mode of worship in which the Israelites were brought up, what they had experienced, their forefathers had experienced in the land of Israel, and what they themselves observed in Egypt, consisted of what? It consisted of sacrificing animals in those temples which contained certain images, to bow down to those images, and to burn incense before them. Therefore, says Rambam, why does the Torah spend so much time and invest so much detail in the laws of sacrifices, in the laws of korbanot, when God doesn't really need them? Right? It's not as though we believe, as the pagans believed, that they would sacrifice animals in order to feed the gods, and that they would pour libations of wine because the gods were thirsty. What Rambam says is, the third paragraph, it was in accordance with the wisdom and plan of God, as displayed in the whole creation, that he did not command us to give up and discontinue all these manners of service. Why? For to obey such a commandment would have been contrary to the nature of man, who generally cleaves to that to which he is used. It would in those days, right? If God had simply told the Jews on their exodus from Egypt, no more sacrifices, no sacrifices, no temples, right? He says it would have made the same impression as if a prophet were to tell us today that we should not pray to God, not fast, not seek his help in time of trouble, rather that we should serve him only intellectually in thought and not by any action. Just as that is something that we could not accustom ourselves to, because it would be a complete sudden reversal of our nature, so it was that the Israelites at the time of Matan Torah could not be told to abandon korbanot, because that too would have been contrary to their nature and experience. By this divine plan, he continues, it was effected. God was able gradually to bring it about, that the traces of idolatry were blotted out, and the truly great principle of our faith, namely the existence and unity of God, was firmly established. This result was thus obtained without deterring or confusing the minds of people by abolishing the service to which they were accustomed and which alone was familiar to them. Now, says Rambam, I know that you will at first thought reject this idea. You'll find it strange, and you'll put the following question to me in your heart, namely, how can we suppose that divine commandments, prohibitions, and important acts, which are fully explained and for which certain seasons are fixed, should not have been commanded for their own sake, but only for the sake of some other thing, as if they were only the means that God employed for his primary object? Namely, if you're telling me that the real purpose behind a mitzvah, let's say a mitzvah of korbanot, it is no value to the korban itself, but it's simply a means by which we distance ourselves from idolatrous practices, then why shouldn't you say the same thing about other mitzvah? Namely, again, as he says, that they were not commanded for their own sake, but only for the sake of something else. What, you might ask, prevented God from making his primary object a direct commandment to us and give us the capacity of obeying it? Those mitzvot, which in your opinion are only the means and not the object, would then have been arguably unnecessary. And here's Rambam's answer to this question. He says, God refrained from prescribing what people by their natural disposition would be incapable of obeying. And he gave the above mentioned commandments as a means of securing his main object, which is to spread a knowledge of him among people and to cause them to reject idolatry. And it is for this reason that he distinctly stated the commandments and the prohibitions, the reward and the punishment. This principle as regard miracles has been frequently explained by us in our works. Rambam tried to minimize, if not to entirely eliminate, the idea of miracles, because God does not want to influence man through supernatural means. God wants to influence man and to bring man to perfection by giving man all of the knowledge that he needs and all of the opportunities that he needs to reach those conclusions himself. The second approach that Rambam pioneered is one that we would call historical. And the best encapsulated description of Rambam's historical approach to Tamei HaMitzvot is contained in the letter that he wrote to the Chachmei Lunel, a letter that he wrote to Jewish scholars who were not, like himself, living in the orbit of Islam, but rather they were living in Provence in the Christian world. And in this letter that he wrote to them that deals mainly with the subject of astrology, he writes as follows. I also have read in all manners concerning all of idolatry, meaning Rambam read widely about ancient idolatry, so that it seems to me, he says, that there does not remain in the world a composition on the subject having been translated into Arabic from other languages, but that I have read it and have understood its subject matter and plumbed the depth of its thought. So that Rambam made it his business to secure copies in Arabic of ancient works of literature through which he was able to ascertain what were the practices and the beliefs of idolaters in the ancient world. From those books, one of which he names in the Moreh HaNivuchim, he calls it the order of Nabataean worship. The Nabataeans were originally a pagan people who were clients, as it were, of the Romans in the Middle East. Okay, I should put with an asterisk that modern scholarship is actually inclined to regard this book that Rambam thought was an original work of ancient idolatry, they regard it as a medieval forgery. So it could very well be that some of the opinions that Rambam formed on the specific nature of ancient idolatry may be factually incorrect, but his perception of the reasons and the motivations behind it are correct nevertheless. In other events, he says, from those books, it became clear to me what the reason is for all the commandments that everyone comes to think of as having no reason at all other than the decree of Scripture, what we call chukim. And he says that the reason behind all of the chukim is that for each and every one, you can find a connection to the defeat of some ancient idolatrous belief or practice. Indeed, he says to these Jewish scholars in France, I already have a great composition on this subject in the Arabic language, meaning the Moreh HaNevuchim, with lucid proofs for every single commandment, which may very well explain why it actually was a Jewish scholar of Provence, Yehuda ibn Tibon, who was the translator of the Moreh HaNevuchim from Arabic into Hebrew. And here is a selection again from the Moreh HaNevuchim in which Rambam illustrates the connection behind between some of the mitzvot, some of the chukim, and as I said, the rejection of some ancient idolatrous belief or practice. And he says, the mitzvot of the second class are those which we have enumerated in the section on idolatry in the book, one of the books of Mishneh Torah that's called Hilchot Avodah Zarah. It is doubtless that they all tend to what? To save man from the error of idolatry and the evil practices connected with it. For example, observing the times, enchantment, witchcraft, incantation, consulting with familiar spirits, what the Torah calls Mechashefa, Ov, Yid'oni, etc. When you read the books which I mentioned to you, right, the books of the Sabaeans, as he calls them, the Chaldeans, you will find that witchcraft, which will be described to you, is part of the customs of these ancient people and to a higher degree of the Egyptians and the Canaanites. After this remark, which you will understand when you have read such of their works as are at present extant, like the book of Nabataean worship, and have been mentioned by me, hear what I will tell you. You see the highlighted passage. It is the object and center of the whole law, the whole Torah, to abolish idolatry and utterly uproot it, and to overthrow the opinion that any of the stars could interfere for good or evil in human matters, because such a belief leads to the worship of stars. And he says, we've explained in our large work that it is prohibited to round the corners of the head. Lo takifu pa'at rosh shechem. It was in the Torah reading just last week. Okay, and to mar the corners of the beard. Right? Why? Because it was the custom of idolatrous priests. Similarly, the wearing of garments made of linen and wool, sha'atnez, is prohibited. Why? Because the heathen priests adorned themselves with garments containing vegetable and animal material, while they held in their hand a seal made of a mineral. So in other words, they saw themselves, they were able there to represent themselves as being the personification of the universe. There was animal, vegetable, mineral. And this, Rambam again maintains, you will find written in their books. But you remember the selection that we saw from Rambam in the Laws of Trespass, where Rambam said, be very careful, and your inability to find a persuasive rationale for any particular mitzvah is not grounds for you to stop observing it or practicing it. He considered that, as it were, to be casting an aspersion against God, as somehow saying, I'm on the same level of God, and if I can't figure it out, then there's no reason for it. So the Rambam still maintains that there is an element, although he emphasizes, to use the term that I introduced earlier, although he emphasizes that capacity, that dimension of mitzvot as being God's wisdom, still maintains that an ingredient in the observance of the mitzvot, nonetheless, is God's will. And here we see it again in yet another portion of the Mishneh Torah. And again, comes at us somewhat from left field. This is his Hilchot Malachim Umilchamotehem, the very last section of the very last book of the 14 constituent books of the Mishneh Torah, where Rambam writes as follows. Kol ha-mekabel sheva mitzvot. Anyone who accepts the seven Noahide commandments, so he's not talking about Jews, he's talking about non-Jews. V'nizhar la'asotan, and is careful to perform or to observe these seven mitzvot. Hareze mechasidei umot ha'olam, such a person is considered a righteous Gentile. V'yesh lo chelek la'olam haba, and he earns a share in the world to come. However, he says, v'hu, providing, he says, v'hu sheyekabel otan, that his acceptance of these mitzvot, v'yaase otan, and his performance of them, is mipnei shetziva bahen hakadosh baruch hu batorah, because God revealed them to us in the Torah. V'hodi'anu al yidei Moshe Rabbeinu shebnei Noach mikodem nitztavu bahem, and he accepts it upon himself because the Torah tells us that that is what God desired. Aval, however, if on the other hand, im asa'am, if he keeps the same seven mitzvot, why? Mipnei hechrea hada'at, not because he accepts them as being divine will, but he accepts them simply because he finds them to be rationally persuasive. Rambam says, "Ein zeger toshav, ve'eino mechasidei ha'olam umot ha'olam v'lo mechach mehem." Rambam's not saying that this is a bad man. But Rambam is saying that such a person doesn't necessarily have a share in the world to come, because a share in the world to come is earned not just by what you do, but it's earned just as well by doing it for the right reason. And the right reason isn't just because you find it rationally, intellectually persuasive, but you find it rationally, intellectually persuasive because what impelled you to seek the rationale in the first place was your desire to do that which is right and just in the eyes of God. It just seems unfair to spend all this time on Rambam and not to spend any time at all on Ramban. So we will spend a little time on Ramban next week as an introduction to the Sefer HaChinuch. But here, just a small serving of Rambam, in case I don't have the occasion to do it next week. This is a selection from Ramban's commentary in the Book of Devarim on the pasuk that tells us that if you encounter a bird's nest, you should first send away the mother bird before taking the. Rabbi Kelman?
Yes.
You hear me?
I do hear you, yes.
Oh, okay, sorry, because we seem to have some problem here at home, so I just wanted to make sure. Okay.
No, I was wondering, I was just waiting to see if everything cleared up. Yeah, everything. Okay. Anybody else have any issues?
Okay, so apropos of the pasuk that says that if you encounter a bird's nest and you want to take the efrochim, you want to take the chicks, you must first chase away the mother bird, which is reminiscent again of a pasuk that we read again in last week's Torah reading in Parshat Emor, that says, Vishor Oseh, right? An ox, a cow, or a lamb, right? Oto ve'et bino lo tishchatu biyomecha, that you cannot sacrifice the mother and the child on the same day. Okay. So Ramban says right? That this, that the reason behind this prohibition, he says, the reason for both commandments is that we should not have a cruel heart, right? And be discompassionate, okay? Right? Or, he says, it may be that the Torah doesn't want us to destroy a species altogether. Okay. Then he continues in the second paragraph and he says, now he, referring to the Rambam, wrote in the Moreh Nevuchim that the reason for the commandment to release the mother bird when taking its nest, as well as the prohibition against killing a dam with its young on the same day, is to admonish us against killing the young within the mother's sight, for animals feel great distress under such circumstances. And Ramban's point is that if the sole purpose for these laws was to prevent cruelty to animals, then the Torah would have made us all be vegetarians, and it would not have permitted us to slaughter animals at all, at any time or under any circumstances. And therefore, he takes issue here with Maimonides' interpretation, rationalization of the mitzvah, and maintains that it isn't out of a desire to not inflict cruelty on animals, but it is that in order to make sure that we do not act in a way in which we would be embedding the element of cruelty in our own natures. And next week, we'll see something we'll say something a little more about Ramban, because the author of the Sefer Achinuch is generally presumed to have been a student of Ramban. So it'll be apropos of our introduction to the Sefer Achinuch. I take a quick look at the chat. Yeah, Christians didn't do as much teaching as Jews did. Christians only taught in seminaries, and therefore they didn't expect to get paid because they were monks or priests and nobody paid them anything anyway. I don't even know if they paid them attention. Muslims, however, like Jews, taught what we would call lay audiences and not just clerical audiences. So there is a difference there. Does Rambam posit... Wow, I'm sorry. I tried desperately as an undergraduate in Yeshiva College to study Greek, and I was thrown out of the class because I didn't know Latin. So I'm terribly sorry. I have absolutely no idea what that means.
No third case.
Pardon?
No third case is given. There is no third possibility. True, false, nothing else.
That much about Rambam's epistemology, I don't know. I know that that doesn't come up in his discussion at the beginning of the Moreh Nevuchim, where he distinguishes between what he calls muskalot and mefursamot. If there is a third category, I'm not aware of it. But then again, it's not something I'm particularly well versed in. Rambam's rationale for shiluach hakein is consistent with the thing God doesn't expect us to give up on habits or natural thought. You didn't get right. Yeah. Okay. You know that Rav Kook at one point in his life practiced vegetarianism. He actually wrote an essay whose title in English is something like The Way to Eternal Peace and Harmony Through Vegetarianism, except that at one point in time, on account of his health, a doctor prescribed a certain amount of meat for him every week, and he followed his doctor's orders. That's it.
That's kind of interesting. So I had heard, and I'm no expert for sure on this, lots of people think Rav Kook was a vegetarian, and then I heard that's just not true. Rav Kook maybe believed, you know, in the future, and perhaps even believed that the Korbanot, only the Korban Mincha might come back. Perhaps he believed that, but that he wasn't actually a vegetarian. So you claim he was a vegetarian for part of his life, and he gave it up for medical reasons. That's very, I don't know. I'm just saying. Is there any evidence one way or another? I guess nobody has evidence. Then we could, nobody. Okay, that's...
I will gladly put it in an email to my cousin Yehuda Mirsky, who...
Oh, Yehuda Mirsky is your cousin, sure.
Yeah, who, if he doesn't know the answer, will either find out or will tell me that it is indeterminate.
Yeah, so I may have spoken to Yehuda about that. You know, he gave a few courses for, you know, on Torah Motion on Rav Kook, of course. He's... somebody's asking me privately to repost the questions. Okay, maybe just wait till we end and then I'll post it. There weren't so many, but I'll try to do that for people who come late. Okay. All right, very good. Talking about the Rambam, of course, with most of it talking about Satmor Beni Gesundheit. We'll be talking about the Rambam's curriculum for the study of Torah. So a different aspect, of course, this is part of his three-part series on preparing for Shavuot. Those who haven't heard Beni, I invite you to come from he'll be in Elon Shvut and medical doctor, creative thinker, and those who have heard him know exactly what I mean. That's tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern, and then tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m. Shira Hecht Kohler will be giving the Parshat HaShavuah Shir, and then of course 9:35 Friday morning I will be continuing my Shir on the Siddur. We're finally going to get to Pesukei Zimra. It's only taken us 31 weeks. And we're finally going to, you know, from Moda Ani to Rabbi Shmuel Omer, it took us 31 weeks. So tomorrow, please God, a Friday, we'll start with Mizmor Shir Chanukah Bayit Levavim. It's not exactly Pesukei De Zimra, but okay. We'll leave it there. And then Rabbi Leiftag on Monday, and then our regular classes next week. Okay, hope everybody's doing well. Comments, questions, always welcome. Suggestions, and of course, always bring a friend. And let me just copy... there really weren't. Somebody asked me to copy it, so let me do that. Okay. Okay, Lila to everybody.
Happy Lag BaOmer.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yes, of course, Lag BaOmer. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, but okay. Okay, so listen, unfortunately, the Lag BaOmer has a different connotation now, I think, after what happened last year. It's not whatever. It's thank God, I think everything went off okay in my run. They took all kinds of precautions, thank God, this year. But anyways, yes, it should be a good...
Like, yes, they posted, well, whatever. It
doesn't, anyway. Yeah. Whatever, yeah. Okay, and, we should hear good news. What can I tell you? A lot worse things have happened during the past year also, but whatever. It's... I just saw now that they want to, I mean, back to our, what used to be our favorite subject, New York City wants to tell people to wear masks again. Are they considering putting in a mask mandate?
They're saying not yet, but they're considering it.
It's very interesting. Yeah.
They're certainly strongly advising it.
Yeah, I mean, I still, listen, I haven't taken off my mask indoors. I mean, in my house, I take off my mask. But when I teach a chat every day, I wear my mask, and 10% of the students wear them, 50% of the teachers or so. But anyways, okay, listen, although, I don't know, are the rates of hospitalization and deaths going up or not really?
The death rate is not going up. The rate of hospitalization, they say, is going up. Some
moderately. Yeah. I still think vaccines. I think that, you know, it's, I assume it's mostly the unvaccinated. That's what was happening here. Even though, no, you don't know.
I don't think that what I'm hearing now, that there are a lot of repeat infections.
Yeah, no, but you can get infected. That's not the issue anymore. The issue is how sick you become. Okay, get it is one thing. But my understanding is pretty much only people who are unvaccinated are getting really sick. That's what I think is happening here. So anyway, all right, we should hear good news. So somebody writing in, actually more dangerous in upstate New York there. I don't know that. A lot of people are getting sick. I hope not. Okay, what can we say? Okay, maybe it's time for dose number 4. You know, I think then 3, whatever. Okay, Lila to everybody. Be well. Hope to learn with you in the near future. And like, see you and your friends. Okay, bye-bye.
Good night.
Have a good night. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Amen. Okay, Lila Tov.